My name's Tom Jennings, and this is the 24 Frames Cast. Now, I need to begin this episode with a personal note. It was my intention last year to do an episode a week, and I had various plans to kind of divide the 24 Frames Cast up into seasons and whatnot. And that was all going swimmingly well, and then something called life came knocking. Sadly, my mother passed away last year, and this would have been a whole lot, I suppose, less awful had my mum not been my father's carer, who currently suffers from Parkinson's and quite bad dementia. It has been something of a massive upheaval in my life. I live here in Manchester, my father lives down in Kent, and between my brother and my aunt and the various carers we now have looking after him, it has been a little bit fraught. On top of that as well was quite a complex system of arrangements, getting kind of my mother's estate in order and whatnot. And frankly, one of those really where it was very sudden and it certainly knocked me for six. And as a result, the podcast just simply became something which I just couldn't really get going again. It was just too much to do outside of that. And mercifully now things have calmed down a bit. We have kind of, I think, as a family, worked a way in which we can help my father without us having to panic all the time and make sure that he's okay. And that has meant that life has come back to me. I was off work for a number of weeks and I'm sort of slowly easing myself back into life. Got quite an exciting project, filming project outside of work on the go, which I'm going to be talking about on the podcast at various points. But the good news is I'm back and ready to go. And I thought I would start because my parents live in a small village, a small town in Kent called Tenston. And I actually did an episode, and what I'm going to be doing today is a re-recording of an episode I did previously on the show, but it was about old cinemas, and there was one in the high street that I kept walking past, and I decided it kind of inspired me to go back to this episode, freshen it up a little bit, and kind of re-record it. So without any further ado, I'm going to call these episodes For One Night Only, for reasons that I will explain in the introductory notes. As I've just said, I live and work in Manchester. I moved here in 2003 from a small village in Kent, and it was, I'm pleased to report, well worth the move. I have fallen in love with Manchester, and the city has been in a near constant state of renewal since 2003. New apartments, office blocks, new football stadium. It's a city skyline that has transformed, and I dare say to some it has changed beyond recognition. It's now certainly filled with rather taller buildings than when I was first moved here, but the past is still very much visible. I live opposite a huge mill, a relic from the Industrial Revolution. The canals are nearby, leading them way into Manchester. Salford still has remnants of its once huge docks. And yet there is one type of building that always catches my eye. A building that speaks to the cinephile in me, and I don't think I'm alone in the small joy that joins me when I spy one of these buildings. More often than not, they look a tad out of place for the purpose they presently serve. Overly ornate brickwork, an art deco curve to the front, a larger than normal roof pointing into a wedge, a name like Scala still visible in the brickwork. For these buildings are, of course, Manchester's now vacant cinemas. Many of these monuments to Manchester's past have been torn down to wake me for something new, but some have survived, and their uses vary from pubs to pound shops to churches. Currently, Manchester has four cinemas. Two are most noteworthy, being the Printworks, which is the most successful cinema outside of London, with an enormous IMAX screen, and the Cultural and Arts Centre Home, that, for the record, does one of the best and most underrated pizzas in Manchester. And yet Manchester used to have 150 cinemas, the length and breadth of the entire city. And it's interesting, when I talk about Manchester's past, as many people will regale you with how they watched such and such a film on 70mm in the 1960s, how the cinema in question offered cheaper tickets on certain days, even remembering how comfortable or uncomfortable the seats were. And when I have these conversations, I'm reminded of the emotional connection we have to cinemas and the trips we make to them. It's not just where we see films there, but often memories of the people we went with, old friends, girlfriends, boyfriends, some we no longer talk to, or perhaps some we are even now married to. And for the record, I met my current girlfriend on our first date at home. And every time I go there, I am reminded of that fact. I remember seeing Lawrence of Arabia at the now closed Corner House and emerging into a beautiful spring sunshine and walking along the Sulphur Canal back to my house. It was, for reasons I still can't quite understand, a perfect day. For some reason, I felt a kind of peace. I was thinking about the film, having for the first time seen it projected on the big screen, and the beautiful weather would cap things off with a pint in the local before going home. And I still think about that from time to time. And whenever I walk past the Corner House, now empty, it reminds me of happy times. And indeed, if you look at the comments section on the Cinema Treasures website, you can see people leaving messages about how seeing the building again triggers a random memory. A group of friends seeing a poster for RoboCop 3 outside the Cine City Cinema in Withington in Manchester, and then having a long chat about the RoboCop franchise on the bus home. Or a projectionist reminiscing about a packed screening of Lord of the Rings. And the journey many of these cinemas go through often tell us about the changing state of trends in society and the film industry itself. A familiar story in the life of a cinema is this. It is built sometimes as a theatre and sometimes dedicated to playing films. It will often change hands repeatedly, sometimes go independent, sometimes become part of a chain, undergo refurbishment from being a single screen to two or three, and if time go by, will slowly die a death whereby they are converted into bingo halls before eventually closing and being changed purpose again. And in some wonderful examples, even reverting back to their original purpose. Many, sadly, are simply demolished to make way for the new. And having watched the Odeon on Oxford Road in Manchester be ground to dust by hungry-looking diggers, it can be thoroughly depressing to see what rises in their stead. And I do think sometimes when these buildings go, there is a real sense of nostalgia and loss. It's a reminder that times are changing, and of course we are moving on, and that's not always a particularly pleasant thought. In a couple of generations, no one will know that the Odeon on Oxford Road ever existed. Indeed, many will see the huge office block that replaced it and barely glance at it and go on about their lives. And that, I suppose, is just life. So I've decided to take some inspiration from all this. What I'm going to do is pick a cinema, now closed or demolished anywhere in the world, research its history as much as I can, give a biography of its life, and with the aid of archive photos, pick one film that I can see that has been advertised either a poster or on the hoarding outside it, and review the film. And I've decided to begin these series of episodes by looking at what cinema I spent a good portion of my younger life, and that was the Maidstone Granada Cinema. The village I grew up in Kent was called Headcorn. It had three pubs, one of which was so awful you could technically say the village only had two. And the citizens of this village were an interesting mixture of city traders, tarmacers, retired German Luftwaffe pilots, and rather more mundane folk like my family. And this was a truly beautiful place where life ebbed and flowed at its own pace. I played a lot of tennis, went to a lovely school, and if I think I'm honest, had a pretty good time. But there was a catch to all this, because if you can't drive in Kent, to put it bluntly, you're fucked. At least that is until you can drive yourself, because pretty much everything is miles from anywhere, which means being at the behest of trains that mostly just either went to London or an hour away, or other small villages. And you had to pay Tom's taxi service, or my dad as he was also known as, or get on the number 12 bus, which went from either Tenston to Maidstone, and would pretty much come and go without any sense of having an actual timetable. Now, Maidstone was the nearest town that also had a cinema, but by bus it was about 40 minutes away, a slow, crawling journey that was supposed to come by every hour, but even that seemed a little bit ambitious, especially during winter for some reason. But yet going to the cinema was a rite of passage for so many young people, because not only was it the first time going to the cinema, it was often your first glimpse of freedom, that moment where mum and dad said you could go on your own, when she thought you could be trusted to do something without supervision. I know I must have been about 13 when I was first allowed to go to the cinema with a mate unaccompanied, because I know I saw True Lies at the Maidstone Granada, which was released in August 1994. And it was a scene of some of my most treasured trips out. I will never forget the smell of Joanne Evans' Coco Chanel perfume as we watched Apollo 13, as I debated whether or not to hold her hand. We were courting at the time. This was early doors, I might add. I'm not even sure if there'd been a snog at this point. All the time I went with my mate Nina and saw the trailer for the Star Wars Special Edition. Now, I know it was a special edition, but hear me out. That normal television screen appearing before suddenly the entire screen was filled with an X-Wing, I was sold. Before that, there were trips back and forth for someone's birthday party, and I definitely recall my dad taking me to watch License to Kill and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. And it was the scene of where I had my greatest trip to the cinema ever. And that was, of course, when I watched Titanic with my then girlfriend, not Joe Evans, I might own. I had that only lasted 6 months. And I don't give a toss what you think of Titanic. That first screening has never been bettered by any trip to the cinema since. It's not my favourite film, of course, but I still recall leaving the cinema at 10:30 in the evening, bleary-eyed, amazed at the film I had just watched. And it was definitely not the most glamorous of places when I was visiting. The carpet had a kind of rank burgundy colour, and my God, the concession stand seemed to cost a small fortune even then. And you were also shown to your seat by someone with a torch. At the time I went, the cinema only had 3 screens, and the third one was a particularly tiny and rather tatty affair. But the Granada wasn't like this in the past. Indeed, once upon a time, it was quite the place to see a film. The story of the Maidstone Granada begins with a man called Sidney Bernstein, a mogul most famous for creating Granada Television, the Manchester-based TV production company, famous for its weekly soap opera, Coronation Street, and I would argue its greatest achievement, the Up series of documentaries. He worked with Alfred Hitchcock to form Transatlantic Pictures, who he met in 1925 when Bernstein was the co-creator of the London Film Society, and the pair formed a lifelong friendship that would see the likes of Rope and Under Capricorn produced under their partnership. A passionate lover of films, Bernstein was the first person to bring Russian filmmakers Sergei Eisenstein and Budovkin to the audiences in London in the 1920s, as well as sponsoring Eisenstein to go to Hollywood in the 1930s. It was Bernstein's father, Alexander, who got him into the business, whose first foray into the entertainment world was in 1907 with the building and music hall, The Empire, Edmonton. Alexander was quick to realise that the public was developing an appetite for cinema. He first purchased Ye Olde Paragon Music Hall in Mile End, London, which was then a 2,000 seat theatre that also showed films occasionally. His first purpose-built cinema was the Empire Ilford in 1913, and it became the first in a number of Empire cinemas that would be built throughout London. This was followed by another company, Film Agencies Limited, formed in 1916, that built and sold equipment, as well as booking and distributing films. Sidney joined Film Agencies, and by 1920 was director and manager, and at some stage developed a keen interest in supplying American filmmaking equipment to British producers. In order to understand the business and the industry better, he travelled to America to look at the equipment that was being used and how it could be integrated into British cinema production. It was there where he discovered the huge movie palaces that were being built, and an idea was born. Following his father's death in 1922, Sidney took over the family business, including the various music halls that the family owned. Bernstein can see where popular culture was heading and cinema was going to be big business, and he wanted to be involved in from every perspective. And it was another trip in 1922 where he visited the various picture palaces and was inspired by the design and build. Perhaps, he wondered, Britain too was ready for these newfangled picture palaces. And Bernstein had an idea to start a chain of cinemas, bigger and better than anything that had gone before. He even had a name. A childhood holiday to Granada in Spain had a profound impact on him, and thus the Granada cinema chain was born. Bernstein worked with architect Cecil Massey during the renovations of his music halls, and Massey was recruited alongside Russian theatre director Fyodor Komissarjevsky. And Bernstein insisted these were not to be called cinemas, they were theatres that would be built. He believed that the audiences would be attracted to the buildings, not the films. He wanted his patrons to marvel at them. Although some would have Art Deco exteriors, the interiors would be neoclassical in design. Crucially, however, the ticket prices would be affordable. Bernstein wanted these places to be temples of entertainment. And I think there's something very telling about this. It is an understanding that cinema is a medium for the masses, but it's also respect for the medium. By creating buildings that would inspire wonder, they are accessible through affordable pricing. Bernstein takes away elitism and makes the audience member, the general public, feel very privileged to be in such a grand place. I got a similar feeling visiting an Everyman cinema, along with big comfy chairs, wine brought to you, lush carpet. It was all rather opulent and ever so slightly joyous. And you can easily imagine the excitement of the punters, perhaps even wearing their best clothes to go. And with that kind of comes a respect for what you are watching and makes you behave in a certain way. And I love the idea that the people going to these places would have been from all walks of life, sitting in the theatre with that amazing architecture. And above all, knowing that you could actually afford to go, it must have been something very special. And Bernstein began to search for location for his first theatres, with the Kent coastal town of Dover being the first. The building would be designed by Massey and Komijewski working on the interior, and soon the Dover Granada was ready to open for business. The premiere night was a sight to behold. Members of the public and dignitaries were transported to Dover in a special railway coach, the Grand Pullman. The opening saw trumpets, speeches, and an appearance by Bernstein and his direct designer and architect on stage. The theatre had one screen, 1,717 seats, a marble staircase, and the auditorium had a Spanish Moorish theme. The stage also had a 35 proscenium arch and an orchestra pit and huge organ that would rise from the floor. The opening film was The Last of Miss Cheney, and its reputation soon spread with punters travelling from all over Kent to watch films there. And from 1930 to 1982, it was used as a cinema, undergoing several changes of hand before becoming a nightclub until 2007, where it was bought by the pub chain Wetherspoons. Yet work was never finished on it, and by October 2014, it had been completely demolished for good. However, back to 1930s, and though soon more Granadas began appearing in Wolstenholme and Tooting, a chain was slowly being born. And of course, the cinema I'll be talking about today, in 1934, my hometown Maidstone got its very own Granada. With a capacity of 1,600, Maidstone Granada became the largest cinema in Maidstone at the time. In 1934, Maidstone had three cinemas, and the Granada was slightly different to the others. For this was the first that would be called the Standard Granada. It was designed by Massey, and Komijewski designed the interior in an Italian Renaissance style with a large chandelier in the main auditorium. However, it was not a protruding from a dome in the ceiling, more it was a flat ceiling with an ornate design around it. It included an enormous Christie III manual 8-rank organ, which I'll talk about more later, and was celebrated by Bernstein as being a very British achievement. He went to great lengths to highlight the labour and materials, the 15 tonnes of imported Italian marble that were made by British workers and tradesperson. It had a car park and a hugely popular bar and cafe. Opened in January 1934, the film Cuckoo in the Nest and Reunion in Vienna, with organist Alex Taylor welcoming the guests in with music, and of course Bernstein himself on stage to give an opening address. Now, like many of its kind, it has changed use over the years. It has hosted concerts by the Rolling Stones and The Who in the 1960s, but its main business was films, and what a place it would have been to see them. Of course, I remember a slightly tattier Granada. And the downfall of the cinema really, I think, began in 1968, when the place was flooded in a rainstorm. The organ console area was destroyed, but the theatre reopened a week later with only the 650-seat upper stall open, and in 1971 it was closed for conversion. The lower stalls were converted into the Granada Bingo Club, with the upper stall and old cafe bar now being converted into a screen, effectively partitioning the cinema. It reopened in 1971 with two screens, one with 560 and the other with 90. The Christie organ too was stripped from the building and eventually shipped to Kelvin Grove High School in Brisbane, Australia, where it is still used to this day. In 1974, a third screen was added, twinning on the larger screen to provide a screen capacity of 258, 259 and 90. And this would be the state that it would remain in until when I was visiting it. In 1989, it was taken over by the Canon Group, MGM in 1993, and then from 1995 to 1996 by Virgin Cinemas, where it was taken over by ABC until its closure in 1999. Its fate was effectively sealed in 1998 with the opening of the Odeon Multiplex in Maidstone. The last film I recalled seeing there was Sliding Doors in 1998. The cinema is still used for a bingo hall today, but the cinema section is still empty. A fire was started by vandals in 1998, although it did little damage, and various people have suggested using the building as a pub or a news club. I wonder how it will end for the Granada Cinema. If bingo goes out of fashion, one could easily see it being sold off for apartments or something similar, or offices, whatever demands of urban culture require. For me, it was a place of amazing memories. Trips to see James Bond and Indiana Jones with my dad, dates with girls, days out with friends, having to wait on teletext to see what films would be playing there, and the slight apprehension that sometimes when you did actually get there, there would be a queue around the block to get in. I'm not even sure that actually happens now. The Granada for me was a place where I came to love films. So many screenings come to mind. Yes, Titanic, Starship Troopers, Apollo 13, Star Wars. And it reminds me of a youth that I have so much fondness for. I drove past it recently and a flood of nostalgia came over. Yes, I'm older, but it did make me long for something, and that something would be the Granada to be returned to its original use. Of course, the cinema has a friends page on Facebook, desperately trying to whip up interest in doing something with it, but I can't shake the idea that Maidstone Granada is very much a building on death row, slowly becoming more irrelevant and more invisible to those around it. I'm not sure from how much long from now, it'll be a pile of bricks and nothing more than the memory for a generation who came of age watching films in it. So, what film did I pick then? Well, I managed to find a picture from the Granada from 1997, and I could just about make out one of the films that was playing, which was Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park, The Lost World. And I actually saw this at the Granada and hadn't catched up with the film in years. So why not, I thought, let's go back and visit it. The original Jurassic Park is a masterpiece of Hollywood filmmaking. It is a magical film in some respects and everything I love about Steven Spielberg. It's scary to a point. It's daft, it's exciting, it has a gorgeous score by John Williams and pretty much is endlessly rewatchable. And of course it was a huge box office success, which of course meant it was going to get a sequel. I don't recall watching The Lost World since I saw it at the cinema, and I realised very quickly when I began to watch it again why that was. Because Jurassic Park The Lost World is a truly terrible film. Sequels, in my opinion, need to do the following. In the first instance, they should enrich the experience of the first film. Blade Runner is a better film because of Blade Runner 2049, which is possibly, I think, even a better film, but that's for another day. Secondly, they should continue the story in a satisfying fashion. The Empire Strikes Back is a perfect example of this. You feel the characters are evolving, as is the story, setting up another film. Thirdly, they have to be a good film in their own right. That doesn't necessarily mean better, but I want a film that can ideally stand up on its own merits, a case being a point, 2010, the year we make content. A vastly different experience from 2001, but a worthy film in its own right. No, it's not better than 2001, but it works as its own thing. It does something that interests me, it's gorgeous to look at, and I don't necessarily feel the compulsion to watch 2001 before watching it. The Lost World fails on every one of those levels, and I think it's firmly because the film has no idea why it exists other than to make money. And it's so creatively bankrupt that it's actually quite depressing. Michael Crichton had never written a sequel before, and he didn't want to either. But after the success of Jurassic Park, he was pressured to do so and wrote The Lost World, worried that the novel would simply be the same but different. And I think it's key to understanding how flat a film The Lost World would end up being. It's clearly a novel and a film, not being born out of a creative spark or some creative impulse to move the story along, but instead is more a box-ticking exercise to appeal to executives. The story sees the introduction of another island, close to the original island and theme park, where essentially the dinosaurs have been left to their own devices. I'm still not entirely sure how this place has remained a secret, and it's never really ever explained, but you soon realise that no one cares anyway, because the whole purpose of this new island is to essentially replay the first film with more CGI. We see Dr. John Hammond, Attenborough, reunited with Dr. Ian Malcolm, Jeff Goldblum, whereupon Hammond casually informs Ian Malcolm that his own nephew wants to go to the island to nick some dinosaurs so they can save the company InGen by opening another dinosaur park in San Diego. But shock horror of all, Malcolm's girlfriend Sarah, played by Julianne Moore, is already there studying the dinosaurs. And of course this expedition is going to need its very own filmmaker in the form of Nick Owen, played by Vince Vaughn, and Eddie Carr, a kind of equipment kind of guy who's going to go along as well, along with a lot of game hunters and various other dinosaur fodder that I can't really be bothered going into. Oh, and Ian's daughter Vanessa, played by Kelly Curtis, has only hidden herself on the boat over. What could possibly go wrong? The Lost World is a film that operates on the strange belief that you won't notice. And by that I mean the following. You won't notice that the film is essentially a retread of the first, because everything you liked about the first film is all present and correct. The dinosaurs, the T-Rex attack at night, the rain, the bad guys being chewed up, John Williams' score, the cute kid in peril, and the snappy dialogue from Jeff Goldblum with that sardonic delivery. What's supposed to happen is you're supposed to just go along for the ride, that you forget the fact you've essentially bought a ticket to the same film, that somehow the audiovisual spectacle with all the will hit all the buttons that the previous film did. Only it doesn't, because what happens is you know exactly what is going to happen, who's going to survive, who's going to be eaten. And yes, it has some decent Spielberg inventive moments. Julianne Moore on a breaking glass is always a nail biter for sure. Spielberg invented the modern blockbuster because of Jaws. I also think him and George Lucas are responsible for cheapening it. Anything Goes was the mantra for Temple of Doom, and that film's crushing stupidity can be seen in any number of big budget Hollywood outings. This sequel has to be one of the biggest casualties of this. Films are brands now, where their name alone is the apparent draw, and I believe there is a kind of cult attitude to them as well. With something like The Lost World, you're supposed to be happy because the film is providing you with an experience that made you enjoy the first one, and whereas some will simply be happy they are back in the world of Jurassic Park, you get the rather strange feeling you're being conned, because as you sat there, you realise this film is doing nothing other than taking your money off you. And there's so much in the film that is eye-rollingly contrived. Kelly has been written in, along with her gymnastic skills, to simply perform a set piece. When you watch the film, you are totally aware of the fact that nothing of anything is actually happening. It's a retread, a boring box-ticking exercise whereby good characters live and bad ones die. The film tries to do something by taking the action back to civilization, but even this is crushingly boring distraction that really exists to make a cack-handed comment on environmentalism and corporate greed. This being a Spielberg film, it is of course competently directed, and as I said before, there are some nice scenes, the dinosaurs running through the grass, that cracking glass scene. Let's not forget, Steven Spielberg has done sequels before, and mainly they're terrible. The Lost World was for me, going back to it, a thoroughly miserable, boring experience. It astounds me that this franchise is still going year after year, and nothing will ever come close in the Jurassic Park world to that original film. It should have just been left there, but of course, Hollywood isn't going to turn down the opportunity to print money, which sadly these films have gone on to do over the years. Hopefully, we'll keep going back to Jurassic Park and reminding ourselves of just how good it is. I've been showing it to my girlfriend's children a lot and they seem to absolutely love it. And being the tyrant I am, I've banned them from watching any of the sequels. Even this has led to tears on a few occasions, but I don't want them to in any way, shape or form have their experience and enjoyment of the first one diluted. And if you are going into this franchise, don't even think of it as a franchise. Just watch Jurassic Park and be done with it. So that's going to be this episode of the 24 Frames Cast. My apologies for the delay in getting this episode out. It's very understandable, of course, you will agree. So that's going to be it for this episode of the 24 Frames Cast. Again, I would like to apologise for the delay. It's not been something that I wanted to do, but I will be getting back to a regular output of shows. So many thanks for listening and sticking with me, and I'll be in contact soon. Bye.